in the studio today for One Lutheran, One Jew, One Hour. It's me, Sue Belita, pastor at Resurrection Lutheran Church. And with me is...
Rabbi Dove Gartenberg.
Welcome back to the studio. We've missed you the last couple of times.
It's nice to be back.
We're glad to have you back. And we would just like to start the show by reminding people that although we do come to speak about issues of faith in this hour, and we welcome your calls and questions, please bear in mind that neither the rabbi nor myself speak for all Christians or all Jews across all times, all contexts, all places. We do bring our backgrounds and experiences to this conversation, and we thought it would be an interesting conversation tonight to talk about change. Since it's New Year's Day, Happy New Year. Well, kind of, sort of. We were talking before the show began that this is not necessarily a new year for you or for me.
That's true, but we know people make resolutions at this time of year, and we figure you're thinking about things you want to change, even if you it's not even a big holiday, but we want to hear about them and talk about them in the context of change within spiritual life.
And we will. So we'll talk about what faith has to do, what change has to do. So give us a call if you have a faithful perspective on what it means to make a New Year's resolution or keep a New Year's resolution. Give us a call at 463-6455. We welcome your calls and your comments. But the main question, as you and I started to talk about this, was what are we talking about changing? Changing from to, what is change?
Well, I think we make a resolution or to change. We often don't target correctly. We assume, say, we want to lose some weight in the coming year, but we may not be looking at all the different causes that are maybe making us gain weight, you know, the stressors or the unresolved conflicts or the relationships we have with others that may create the anxiety that causes us to overeat. So sometimes we look at some sort of cause or secondary cause when we examine what we want to change. If we were to go deeper, we might find other things to look at too.
So we start basically on the surface of saying we want to do something differently. Is change about doing something differently?
Change can be an intentional act to do something differently from what you've done in the past. Change can also be something that happens to you. A change from the outside that alters your routine or alters your expectation of what's going to happen.
Okay, so could you give an example of that?
Well, I guess the most obvious example that we all have is when we have a death in the family. Someone who has been present and very much in our lives is no longer present and our reality in our lives. We only have a memory, and that change is one of the most, it's a change we dread, of course, but it's a profound change in our own reality because of the loss of presence of that person, the role they played in our lives. And we can't feel the same. It's now a completely different reality, an altered reality, especially the closer the person is to us.
So in terms of faith, do you think there's a difference between changing, doing something differently and adapting to circumstances?
Well, I think there's certainly a different process that's involved when you are adapting to a change that's occurred and from an attempt to alter a reality that you live in intentionally. I certainly think that our religious traditions make that, can't understand that distinction, and help and provide resources for people on at least those two types of change. We'll probably examine. I don't, if Sue, you think of other types of ways that change introduces itself to us.
Well, that is something that I think we can continue to play out. But really where we started with the topic is that sort of resolution mm-hmm. that people make. And that tends to be, you know, I'm going to lose weight, I'm going to stop smoking, I'm going to write my mother more often, or, you know, something very particular that tends to be about a negative self realization or a truth about ourselves that we wish that we could do differently.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw something very interesting, because I do think that change, one of the things you and I talked about is what is the motivation for a change. And for many people, so it's a new year, it's a fresh start, that becomes the motivation. I'm going to change because it's a brand new year. And so I'm going to wake up and everything's going to, the potential, the possibility of doing something different from this marker, that you've got a particular marker of here's mm-hmm. where I change. And, of course, marketing takes advantage of all of those good intentions or those desires to do something differently in your life and, you know, flood us with gym memberships and video exercise videos and stop smoking seminars and all of those kinds of things. You know, it's market prime time right now. And yet so many of, like, the morning talk shows or programs like this even would say, let's come back in 2 weeks and see how long you've kept that resolution.
I just heard a story on this radio station about that gym's plan, their marketing, that is that they of people who will join and not come to the gym.
Right.
So what's the availability of their machines, despite the fact that 100 new people join in the first week of January, and they can pretty much by having analyzed it over the years, know that those 100 people, very few of them will show up. They'll show up a couple times, and then they'll remain members and they'll pay their dues because they collected them up front.
Right, but there's something so, I think, true and so alive and so human about how often we fail in the midst of change.
Uh-huh, that's true.
And I think there needs to be, maybe that's a place where grace or love or those things that, you know, part of it is we understand that we do fail in the midst of our desires to change.
That is recurring, and I guess that there can be some differences in our faith traditions around the emphasis of the likelihood of failure or of the necessity of laying the conditions that make it more successful. I mean, actually, I think it's a fascinating issue about that, and we talked about this earlier in the year or last year. About repentance, which mm-hmm. is mm-hmm. this idea, the religious idea of change, of moving away or rejecting sin. And, you know, the same issue there applies to people who are trying to overcome bad behavior or sinful behavior, however you want to label it, what do we need from God to succeed, right? What do we need from our loved ones to succeed? What do we need from inside to succeed to make the change? And that's important to think about that.
Well, it is, and I do think that as we talk about, you know, really this, what it is to move yourself from one place to another, mm-hmm. to be something different, to act in a different way, I think so many of those resolutions are made without necessarily a connection to their faith, to a faith tradition.
Oh, most resolutions are very much part of our real situation. I mean, I'll give you a couple interesting traditions within Judaism. One a tradition and one an actually famous text in Judaism. There is the tradition on the Day of Atonement. You know, the Jewish New Year's was already a few months ago. And actually, to be honest with you, at the beginning of the hour, you know, well, what is this? Is this really New Year's for you? For me, it's actually not New Year's.
For me, it's not actually New Year's either. So.
And we all, you know, there are different New Year's traditions even within one faith. But you know so while we don't have resolutions in our New Year, we have this idea of change, of repairing relationships, and making vows to become, a better person. But we also have in the evening of the Day of Atonement, we have a prayer, a very famous prayer called Kol Nidrei, where we annul our vows from the past year. And generally vows we made, in the passion of the moment, stupid vows, unrealistic vows. And so the tradition's very, very aware of the tendency of people to, in a moment of anger or in a moment of passion, to say things and make promises that they won't, when they calm down, they won't keep.
Mm-hmm.
So you have this tradition of annulling vows like that on Yom Kippur. But the other thing I was thinking about is there's a very famous passage in Maimonides' philosophical book, The Guide to the Perplexed, where he says, in regards to Israel when it went out of Egypt, and this is not the movie, by the way, not this is, but
that's another show.
That's another show. But that when they went out, when they God took them on the long route, and not the short route. They could have gone up the Via Maris, right into the land of Canaan, 3-day journey. And God didn't take them. Maimonides says it basically comments that it's impossible for a person to change immediately, that there is a long road to change. And I think that's both now as my experience of over 3 years as a rabbi and living my years, I would say that's true. I think people rarely change immediately. They change slowly. But changes can be profound.
Well, one of the anecdotes that I have is that in preparation for a season, a spring season for us, the season of Lent, which is those 40 mm-hmm. days before Easter, which again, another 40 days, the 40 years that the mm-hmm. Israelites were wandering. And so I did a search on Amazon for book titles that had 30 in them. And got, 30 days to thinner thighs, 30 days to train your dog, 30 days to learn a new language, 30 days to auto repair, 30 days to anything. You could learn anything in 30 days. And then I put in 40 days. And it was interesting to me that 40 days, all of the book topics had a spiritual component. 40 days of walking with Martin Luther, 40 days of prayer, 40 days of devotional readings, 40 days of, mm-hmm. These kinds of things. So I said, what changes in those 10 days? That there's something, I think, that's rather profound about going beyond the border, the marker, the line
mm-hmm.
of here's how long it takes. And if in faith traditions, it's like, take 10 years more or take 10 days more.
You're not done.
You're not done. And, there's nothing really to say that you're done in those 40 days either, but there is something profound about going beyond a predictable measure of time.
Right.
And I do think that in terms of resolutions, it can often be that same thing where, you say, I'm going to do it for the whole year. Well, we found out that really doesn't hold a lot of mm-hmm. promise. So some people say, if I just do it for the month of January, I'm just really curious, and I wonder what would happen if people took on a challenge to say, I'll do it for 40 days.
So you have to finish what you're doing by Valentine's Day.
There you go.
Yeah.
There you go. Well, and it is an interesting thing. So one year I gave up Diet Coke for Lent, which is a 40-day period, And I drank Diet Coke morning, noon, and night. I was the poster child for Diet Coke. And so I figured this was, a time of changing myself, of giving up something that I thought about all the time and indulged in all of the time, Diet Coke, Diet Coke, Diet Coke. And I was so excited then as the days got closer, because on Easter, I was going to be able to have a Diet Coke. And having gone without it for 40 days, when I finally had a Diet Coke on Easter, I had lost the taste for it. It tasted awful, actually, at that point. And I've not had Diet Coke since. So I do think that there's something
you should write
about
well 40 days
40 days
to get over
Diet Coke. right. I bet I don't get any corporate sponsorships for that one. But I do. I mess around with this whole notion of 40 days and going beyond just our calendars, and you know, mm-hmm. we've talked about our years being different, but we can push ourselves to do something beyond what we expect, or for more days than we expect. Then maybe that's part of the process of being mm-hmm. prepared and shaped and changed.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you have some good insight there, and you know there's a mindfulness about it. People talk about mindfulness traditions, and it's a mindfulness of being attuned to what you want to do, and to. And it's like there's also a discipline to change. That it's not something that you just will. There's a pattern of changing the regular daily behaviors that you do, so that that attention to that over time causes the body to change physiologically, and to not have a craving.
Mm-hmm. But I do think, again, in the midst of that. Embracing the failure,
mm-hmm.
that isn't necessarily failure, that may be more of just the reshaping.
Mm-hmm.
And so not to give up in the midst of that, you know, so you go 29 days and, you know, then you crack open a Diet Coke. Well, it doesn't mean that you are a failure. It means that you just are going to start again.
Right.
Is there faith? Disciplines that help us to do that process, though? Do we have the support of our faith traditions? Are there prayers? Are there practices? What helps support our desires to make these changes?
And if anyone wants to call with their story about that, we certainly welcome you to call.
Absolutely, 463-6455.
Well, I'm just thinking within your Jewish tradition, you have a number of ways in which you can make a commitment to change. Although there is nothing, we don't have a confessional where you go to a certain clergy to say you've done this and you want to change. It's all pretty much a matter of instituting the change yourself, you know. So in the Torah talks about the Nazarite. Mm. You know, the Nazarite was someone who might make a devotion, who might change a behavior and avoid wine, to not cut the hair.
Mm-hmm.
So the Torah knows of a certain type of major behavior change that would signify your wanting to, that signified an intention and involved a certain sacrifice of avoiding things.
Well, and one of the things that we had talked about was the motivation for the
right.
change.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what is spurring the change? And it's been my experience that things like guilt and shame are not good motivators for change, that those actually just create sort of a negative spiral. And so if you look at a desire, a motivation to change out of, so you say, you know, oh, I feel terrible that I'm spending all this money on cigarettes, but you change it into a positive, I really want to be alive to see my kids graduate from high school. You know,
mm-hmm.
that the motivation, the underlying motivation, if you change it away from I'm a terrible person because I do this, or because I eat this, or I drink this, or I think this, or whatever. You know, the negative motivators I'm not thinking are as fruitful or as productive as finding some positive motivation to inspire the change.
Well, that may be you. I'm not sure. I do think, I certainly have seen in my life people who have hit rock bottom,
mm-hmm.
And are disgusted with themselves, feel shame, they do feel that they've reached, they've reached the end of the road on their situation in life, and begin a process of change. It can be highly motivated. The question is, do people, how effective, how sustaining, what causes a person to preserve the change, both the motivation and the discipline to make the change? And I think also what might have started as a very negative motivation can become a very positive motivation over time. So that a person, a person can grow in their motivations spiritually.
Hmm.
So I've seen people who have had a lot of shame who have changed their lives, but as they go through this process, they begin to see, they go beyond the shame to seeing how they can help others or how they can become a better person. And that's really what's marvelous.
Right.
Because the motivation, sometimes the motivation has to be pretty radical.
Well, but we've talked, there's a difference there. You're talking about initial impetus,
right,
and sustaining change.
Right.
And that's different. You know, the initial impetus to change may be, the trigger may be mm-hmm. a shame or a guilt, but the ability to sustain or maintain a path of change takes time,
right,
as you said. And in the midst of that time, then the motivations can alter to be sustaining,
right,
or helpful.
Right, right. I think that's actually very, very, it's well put, and I think that's a key to anyone making a resolution this time of year.
I do. I think that's where I want to keep cycling back to, is it takes time
mm-hmm.
to do things. And there are some things you can begin to do and help pattern them
mm-hmm.
into your behaviors or your life.
Mm-hmm.
But to allow it some time to really cement itself in and to change you.
Mm-hmm. That's true. That's good.
Huh?
Part of what we were discussing the other day, prelude to this show, is the issue of there's a view in our modern society, modern culture too, in the West, that we can't change. That we are born with certain genetic factors that we've inherited, and that gives us predispositions towards certain things, whether it be alcohol or drugs or foods or tendencies and relationships and so forth, or even I work in the field of mental health, that the view today, which I accept, is that mental illness is are illnesses. They're brain disorders.
Mm-hmm.
So that, the question then becomes, if we inherit these things, what does change mean then?
Right.
Are there certain conditions or things that we have that we can't change? Because they are determined by our genetics. There are views of the world that see that basically we are made up, our genetic makeup, or our makeup really leads us to behaviors and things that are very hard, if not impossible, to change.
Right. But that doesn't... sometimes then I think we focus on the one element that we can't change, and mm-hmm. that can lead to despair or frustration mm-hmm. or a sense of a defeat, when in fact there may be tangential circumstances around us
mm-hmm.
that, for better or for worse, that we can impact and can influence and can change, do you think?
Well, it's highly specific, I think. I mean,
that's
I think
true.
People face, I'd be great if people, someone wants to call and tell us about a particular thing that they had difficulty changing,
Or success
they had in changing. And because those are, I think they're important to acknowledge also to our loved ones. And I think that's a key in relationships. Over the holidays, we get together with family members. And I think a lot of us in our families tend to think that behaviors of family members who irritate us or who annoy us or who disgust us, not to mention our own behaviors, are pretty fixed. That's the same old dynamic. Every year, it's the same old dynamic.
We fall into those patterns
right.
when we get back with that same group of people.
Right. So
it doesn't have to be just family. One of my favorite stories is in seminary, every Wednesday, a group of us would go to this Mexican restaurant, and that was sort of our breathing time. And we all kind of fell into ordering a certain pattern. One person would always order the number two platter, and one person would always order the vegetarian tacos, and I would always order the Super Azteca, and, this kind of thing. 3 years later, we came back together for a reunion, and we all went out to the Mexican restaurant, and we all ordered exactly the same thing that we had ordered in that. So, I mean, we do sometimes become comfortable in our patterns. And so, what we order at a Mexican restaurant, that doesn't need to change. But there is also a dynamic of becoming so comfortable with our patterns that we don't see that mm-hmm. change could benefit or excite or inspire. So part of the changing is about risking sometimes.
It certainly is risking. And also, I think when we talk about groups, we talk about change in groups, think about your communities that you're part of, whether it be a mm-hmm. church mm-hmm. or a club or some professional group, and also think about the situations where change needs to happen, right, and how difficult mm-hmm. it is. How difficult it is to make those changes happen. I've been asked to help a nonprofit group in this community with changes that mm-hmm. they want to make. I'm being hired as a consultant, and so I was thinking about, they want to change, or at least they say what they want to change, but. And I'm going to give them some suggestions on how they might change, but how will they accomplish that? Who's going to take on the role as the lightning rod?
Sure.
Right? I remember my experience as a clergy person of community saying they wanted change, and when I got there, they had no intention of changing. So in my own history, I generally tend to be a change agent,
mm-hmm.
and I've experienced tremendous resistance to change, even sometimes getting quite emotional resistance to change.
Well, how many Lutherans does it take to change a light bulb?
How many?
Lutherans don't change. Andrew,
I thought that was Calvinist.
No. Well, if you're a Calvinist and you want to defend yourself, go ahead and give us a call. But it's been the Lutheran joke for many years. So change is, so that's an interesting dynamic. We're talking pretty freely about what does change mean and resolutions being change and being change agents. But again, sometimes people just don't want to change. they're perfectly happy. Or not necessarily happy, but they don't see a reason, a motivation for changing.
Yeah, and I think actually it's interesting because why shouldn't religious considerations about change or wisdom about change apply to groups as well as individuals? I mean, I've run into groups, people, ostensibly religious groups, where they don't believe in change. I mean, and they aren't prepared. Again, it's very contextual, right?
Right.
So contextual, right. And also the collection of personalities that you have within a group. But groups can resist changes for the not only good of the group, but the good of the community around them.
Well, and again, I do think that there is a particular comfort. I went one time to a meeting of people that it was an open meeting, but this group of people had been meeting together for a long time. And so when I came, I was different. I was an intruder, really, into this group that, by all intents and purposes, was meant to welcome anybody who walked in the door. But quite honestly, I was not welcome. I was an interloper into this group that had been formed for a very long time and knew their rhythms and their patterns and their stories, and they didn't want to start with a new person walking in the door. So there's a lot of group resistance to change in lots of different ways.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
No, I recall when a pulpit I had in my career where I was leading the service, and if I changed even the melody because there are multiple melodies for that you could do for any particular section of the prayer. If I changed the melody, the person just had a fit. In front of everybody, by the way. So,
so you're deeply scarred by this experience.
I didn't know whether to laugh or just, I don't know. But, you see it just, it's quite, then you have to understand the perspective of people's resistance to change and what they see as holy and fixed. I think the view of God, people can expect God to be holy and fixed and the same and not, it sort of make their God a pretty static God, in my opinion. But it's really a fascinating issue and an important issue.
Well, I do love that paradox of an unchanging God who changes God's mind. So if God can look at a situation and say, wow, I see that you've done this, so now I will respond by doing something different than what I had anticipated I would do. I found that wonderful and powerful and delightful. But it is sometimes unsettling for people who want an unchanging God.
Yes, or an unchanging God, or an unchanging reality, or an unchanging group that they're part of. I actually think every one of us has some aspect of that resistance to change, depending on our station in life, our situation in our lives, whether the group, the importance of the group to us. There's this whole, I guess, maybe assumption that as we get older, we get more rigid, we resist change, right? I question that assumption,
but I think it's
very commonplace, and people, the ageism of our culture, tends to project onto older people that they are people who resist change. It's pretty, I think it's a pretty pervasive issue.
I do. Yeah. Here's what I find interesting just about the pattern of our conversation so far, though. I mean, we introduced the topic and we talked about changing and some types of changes and, changes that we want to make ourselves, changes that are thrust upon us or by circumstance. And then as the conversation is unspooled a little bit, how easy it is to talk about our frustration with other people who will not change or other groups. And we've all had that experience that, you know, if only so-and-so would change, then I could get along with him or her better. Or if this group had welcomed me in, then I could have been a part of that group. Or if only they would have taken my advice. To me, it's really interesting. And I think that's not an uncommon pattern that, you know, we talk about what it takes for someone else to change. We deflect right. a lot of change, I think, from our own selves. Do you think that might be true?
It is true all the time. it is true all the time. I mean, if we, you know, there is a, you know, the self-aware change agent, you know, someone who understands they're making change but also is involved in changing themselves is, I think, rare. I mean, it takes, although I do think people, I mean, certain fields are taught as change agents to be aware to I think it's, you know,
right.
self-awareness is
right.
is a very important thing, but also, given the unpredictability of human reaction, we may institute a change and set off a series of events that really is completely different than what we thought.
Well, that happens most of the time. When you change something, you have no idea that the
right.
cascading effect that's going to come from that change.
Yeah, and I guess, too, I mean, this is part of the interesting issue. You know, as a rabbi who comes out of a denomination that is called conservative, which mm-hmm. means to conserve, not that it has any political, forget the political use of the term, but you are taught to conserve the tradition, but at the same time, as a centrist liberal movement, we are committed to making changes to make the tradition relevant.
Mm-hmm.
So actually, the byword of the movement for, and I think it still is, my movement is tradition and change, which is it's a real contradiction. And then how do you make decision of when to conserve and when to change? I mean, what becomes, you know, so, and I, you know, it's interesting now, my perspective and sort of following, religious life in America now for 40 years is that the centrist movements, and I'm sure this is true in Christianity too, are struggling because to preserve that tension of tradition and change takes a lot of self-awareness, and people don't, you know, not only self-awareness, but just thoughtfulness.
Right.
And a lot of people don't want that in their religion. I mean, they don't want that. They, you know, so for whatever reason, it is, you know, that's an interesting factor of our time and our polarizing times.
Well, and, you know, in terms of congregations, again, you know, the whole thing about Lutherans don't change, but to introduce a new hymnal, like you said, a new melody to mm-hmm. A prayer, or to introduce a new hymnal or a new way of doing things, it takes that thoughtfulness, it takes preparation, it takes motivation and dedication to do that. But then it's so funny because that change then becomes the tradition.
Right.
Until the next change happens. And then, you know, the people who fought so vigorously against that change, once it becomes tradition, then they're going to fight for that tradition. You know, there is this joyful irony that happens in the midst of those, in that tension of tradition and change, which I think every religion experiences.
Yes, it's absolutely, and it is really, you know, religious reform or change has a fascinating history of, I think there's a cycle within religious groups and congregations between the reformist period to the reforms are adopted and then they become institutionalized, mm-hmm, and then at a certain point there's a new, you know, people want, you know, they don't like those new traditions. You know, I think I would argue too that in our times everything is so speeded up,
right?
You know, you see it in nature, you see it in so many realms,
you see it in
technologies,
iPhones.
But in religious life too, everything is speeded up. So things that are overthrown, the new things that replace them they become themselves traditions that are overthrown.
Right.
So if you look, for instance, in my movement's publication of prayer books, is that for many generations, there were very few, that publications were, it would last 60, 70, 80 years.
Right.
Now they don't last 15 years.
Right.
And they're being changed. You know, so the pace of change has heightened. It's part of the reality of our world.
So it's interesting, again, at the top of the hours, we began thinking about personal change. Mm-hmm. We talked about the time that it was needed. Mm-hmm. And here, you know, as we talk about institutional change, that it happens so quickly. So
that's right.
Change, really, I'm hearing this word tension in lots of different aspects as we talk about change, that it is there is a tension, there is pressure, there is frustration and things that rub together and rub against each other as we talk about change, whether it's personal or institutional.
Mm-hmm.
Well, again, just to send out an invitation, if you have changed or if you have resisted change, perhaps, go ahead and give us a call at 463-6455. We're interested in your stories because, as you can tell, we can just keep on telling stories.
We would love to hear your
questions. And we'd love
questions.
To hear your
stories. We know that you have tempting football games.
Right? But we do enjoy stories. They are the lifeblood and lead us into change. You know, as I bring it back out of the institutional to the personal, I had a friend who called and one of the things that we talked about is how, as clergy leaders, as pastors,
mm-hmm,
it takes a particular discipline to keep feeding your own spiritual life as well. And I confessed that one of the things that I do when I go into my office, the first thing I do is turn on my computer. That's my first action. I walk in the door and I turn on my computer. And as the computer boots up then, I get involved in that. I'm checking emails, and suddenly my day has begun. And I said, I really would like to do something other than that. And I am I've never found a good pattern for prayer for myself.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been to prayer workshops. I've been to prayer retreats. I've bought books on prayer. I've done labyrinths. I've done color wheels. I have tried to pray in lots and lots of different ways. And I said to this friend, because I think having somebody to be accountable to is also a part of making change into a habit. So I said to this friend, because I'm telling you this, now I'm going to do it. Where instead of unlocking my door and coming across my office and turning on the computer, I'm unlocking the door and then turning around and going to sit in the sanctuary. I light a candle and I just sit there. And I've been doing that for a couple of weeks now. I don't always pray, whatever, you know, I don't do necessarily formal liturgical prayers. I just sit there. And thoughts come and go. Sometimes my thoughts go too, mm-hmm, quickly, and I say I need to just sit here and be quiet. Sometimes I just watch the candle. But I've done that now for a couple of weeks, and I can't tell you how good that feels. One day in the midst of that, I walked in. This is my lapse, right? I walked into my office. I turned on my computer, and I immediately got involved in an email, and I felt anxious.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had to turn around and walk away and go and start first by just, and I sometimes it's 4 minutes, sometimes it's 10 minutes. I really don't know how long it is. It's not very long, but it's just being in that place and not letting my day start without a connection of some sort. I'm 2 weeks in, people, with one lapse. And so I'm hoping I can go for my 40 days.
40 days. Go for your 40 days. I'll check in on you and
there,
see if...
Yeah, see, now I've made all listeners...
All of Juno now
are my accountability partners. See right. If, check in with me.
It's going to be sitting in the sanctuary. What time of day is that?
That would be usually at 9 in the morning.
9 in the morning.
Between 8:30 and 9, yeah. Check in at Resurrection Lutheran Church.
Is she in the sanctuary?
Oh, I don't know. Maybe I've done a good thing. Maybe I haven't done such a good thing. So in your, because you did not start out as a rabbi, so what were there practices that you had to change that you, that now feed you spiritually in the midst of making that change?
Sure. I could, one of the changes I made was I didn't grow up observing the dietary laws, and I began to observe the dietary laws, which were hard because there were foods that I enjoyed that, you know, were restricted.
No more bacon cheeseburgers.
No more bacon cheeseburgers. I just heard about someone making bacon latkes, which are the food for Hanukkah, but it doesn't quite work.
That's so
wrong. Yeah. Well, not for a lot of people, I guess. But the... growing up in a reform home and then choosing to become more traditional and conserve, so I became kosher and all. Really, it was not a sudden thing. It was a very slow, because I first of all had to learn. A lot of people who grow up, if you're a person who grew up in a kosher home, that was something you were introduced as a child, and that was the reality of the world. But to me, it was a choice. That was something as a young adult, and not a common choice.
Mm-hmm.
So there was not. I mean, although in the sub community I was in, and we were other people who were learning and doing, and so that was a, and actually it became part of my life, and I've never veered from it. Although there are a lot of jokes about rabbis veering from it, but it's it's not a, it's really something that's really part of my life. But it took a long time to really adopt. And it did start with the positive motivation of wanting to become more mindful of what I ate and mindful of the traditions of my people around food. So that's something that's... And I've made changes, like I'm more of a vegetarian diet. And all the changes around food we've witnessed in American culture around local eating, and slow eating, and some vegetarianism. All those things have impacted the way I eat, but it's not made me veer away from being kosher. In fact, there really is an argument that kosher has strong sensitivities, ecological sensitivities that are quite ancient, but that make it easier to adopt now.
Again, I'm hearing, and so for those of you who are listening, really the power of time. I think a lot of times, especially with religion, that there's a myth maybe that once you accept a religious life, once you accept Jesus into your heart, once you accept a spiritual path, once you accept become a part of a community, that your life is going to turn around. Your life is going to be suddenly different and beautiful and wonderful. And part of what we've talked about across these last, this time, this conversation, is that all of these changes, the types of changes, whether they're institutional or personal or relational or group, they do take time. And to give ourselves that gift of time. You know, here we are at New Year's and we're talking about resolutions and it's just after Christmas. And there is something particular about the gift of time, a gift of a whole new year, the gift of of weeks and days and day by day, you know, to stretch out in front of you, to not be disappointed and to not be frustrated and to continue to hope, sometimes in the spite of our disappointments and frustrations, that change is happening, maybe in ways that we can't even mark or note or expect.
Yeah, and maybe that's also a sort of secret to making New Year's more meaningful. I know that a lot of what's valuable about the Jewish New Year's is you're not really thinking forward, you're thinking back. You're thinking back of things you might have done in the past year and really trying to recall with some specificity the things that you may have done wrong or hurt someone. And then making what really was a long-delayed behavior change or actually an apology that should have been done sooner. And then making that during that season. So that by doing that, the change, and then you're making the change, the inner work that makes the change or resolution going forward more possible. So I, in a certain way, a day like today might be good to think about what happened in 2014. What did I do? How did I change? How did I fail to change? How did I... what people came into my life, what people left my life. You know, those types of reflections, I think, are part of making a New Year's, not only New Year's meaningful, but also a laying the groundwork, the fertile ground for change in the coming year.
And there's something profound in what you're talking about in terms of also letting go of that. And so of a releasing of all that you were unable to do or that you did badly, of saying, you know, that is now past. And how can I now move forward out of that past by remembering it but also letting it go?
That's right.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, this has been a journey that I don't think we, either one of us, expected in our conversations for it to quite go. I'd like to just... for a moment, talk about the whole notion you came around that we've touched onto a couple of times about change that we don't necessarily desire but that comes upon us when there's illness or death or a move or a job change. You know, how does our faith support us in the middle of you know, when we're the eye of the hurricane, sort of, when all of this chaos and change may be happening around us?
I mean, how do you respond? What's a healthy or a good response to that? And it seems to me there is it's important to watch and to observe. This is something my wife has taught me through the mindfulness practice of watching and just being attentive to what's going on, how the changes are impacting you. You know, there's a beautiful Jewish tradition around, say, when there's a death, we call it Shiva. Now, there's actually taking, we've been talking about time, and I think this is another thing that's speeded up in our culture. People, when they have a death, they're pretty quick to resume their lives. And actually, Jewish tradition has a seven-day period where you sit. It's actually called Shiva, meaning sitting. Sitting and mourning. Where your behavior changes and also the behavior of the community toward you changes, so that people, you are relieved of your obligations, and the community comes and feeds you, and they come and they bring prayer to your home as opposed to you going to the synagogue.
Mm-hmm.
And I think about this thing about, you know, change that occurs in our lives from the outside, that really you need time just in the same way to make that adjustment and to realize the loss, as well as to lay again the fertile groundwork to change for the better. There's also another beautiful tradition I've worked with people on, is of loved ones writing ethical wills for their children, that at, when their lives end, they read them during the Shiva, and that really is sharing their values and hopes for their loved ones that survive. And it's just a wonderful gift of reflection on what a person meant to us, and some of the things that we might want to do through action. That is, not through just how we think, but through action,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
to realize the purpose of their lives. So those are just a couple things out of our tradition that where I think there's a lot of wisdom around these external changes that happen to all of us. You know, we have, of loss and of radical realignment, and I think it's really a powerful way, and to be in communities that honor that, because you can't do this. It's hard to do this alone. It is hard to do it alone.
And see, I think, again, it seems like there are particular threads that run through no matter what kind of change we're talking about,
mm-hmm.
that there is time, there's a need for support, whether they're accountability partners or a community,
mm-hmm.
or a group or a congregation, and that there's tension, that, you know, that mm-hmm. it's a chafing thing, changing rubs and makes us raw and is hard. And I think it would be fair to do that. Sometimes there's almost a breeziness or a carelessness to resolutions. And I think that's part of the conversation we wanted to have today, that there is nothing breezy about change, that it is hard, that it takes time, it takes people around you to do it, and that it can often bring tension into our lives. So I know we're coming towards the end of our time, but is there a prayer that you had that you brought in that may support the notion of changing?
Here's something. This is a book, a beautiful book, by a colleague of mine, Talking to God, Rabbi Naomi Levy. And this is a prayer for facing our faults. We talked about self-awareness. So I'll share this one with you to end our program. Did I get the right one here? A prayer for facing our faults. I have been hiding from my faults, God. I've been blaming others for my own mistakes. Help me, God, to search my soul. Teach me to be honest with myself. Give me the courage to accept responsibility for my actions. Grant me the humility to ask for forgiveness from those I have injured. Fill me with the desire to change, God. Remind me that I have the power to remake my life. You have filled me with enormous potential. Teach me how to realize all the gifts of my soul. Be my guide. God, lead me to goodness, to joy, to learning, and to peace. Amen.
Amen. Thank you so much, Rabbi Dov Gartenberg. With One Lutheran, One Jew, One Hour. Thank you for being here this evening.
Thank you. It's great to be with you, Sue.
And our next program for One Lutheran, One Jew, One Hour, we are on every first Thursday of the month. So Thursday, February 5th, will be our next installment here on KTOO News Juno 104.3 from 7 o'clock to 8 o'clock. We thank you for your listening. We thank you for being a part of our conversation. Coming up next, more programming from NPR, National Public Radio. And just a reminder that it's going to be rainy with lows tonight in the 22 to 28 degree area. And we may get up to 2 inches of snow. And that Friday, it's going to be windy and colder. Stay warm, Juno. Blessings to you all.
After the 11th of September, certain people in this country, including your president,